friends, welcome to the Three Pillars podcast with your host, Griselda Barreto. Aviation. Today's guest is Aap van der Kratz, accompanied by his partner, Annie de Vries. Born in 1954, Aap grew up in the Netherlands. He received his flight training in 1972 to 1975 at the Dutch Government Flight Academy. After that, he spent 3 years in small aviation, performing banner towing or advertisement flights, aerial photography and sightseeing flights over the Netherlands. In 1978, he joined a large Dutch airline company and spent 33 years there with great pleasure. After 7 years as a co-pilot on the DC-9, he upgraded to captain on the DC-9, the Boeing 737 and the Airbus 310 respectively. He flew all short and middle range routes. In 1994, he became a captain on the Boeing 747-400, which was the long-haul aircraft. During the last 5 years before his retirement, his partner Annie would frequently accompany him on his trips, which they both enjoyed a lot. In 2011, he retired in good health and was fit, and he wasn't too keen to give up his active flying yet. So when he was offered with the opportunity, he happily accepted a position as a captain on the Boeing 747-400 in a South Korean company. Unfortunately, in middle 2014, he suddenly got several acute health problems like sudden hearing loss, neurological disorders, and extreme fatigue. That was the abrupt end of a flying career and the start of a very difficult period with lots of doctor's appointments, getting to accept his limitations, and searching for possible causes. He was very lucky to come in contact with John Midavane, an ex-orthopedist who specialized in sports and orthomolecular medicine. With his professional guidance, food supplements, and some supporting therapies, Aap's daily life gradually became more normal again. Hi, Aap and Annie. Welcome to the Three Pillars. I'm so glad to have you on the show this evening. How are you doing?
Hi, Griselda. Thank you very much. We are doing quite well. Thank you for having us on the show. We're happy to share our experience with the listeners.
Hi, Griselda. Thank you very much for inviting us. Yes, like Aap said, we're very happy to share our story.
So before we start, may I ask either Aap or Annie just to give me a short description of who you are?
Well, I'm the partner of Aap, and like you know, Aap came home ill, what turned out to be erotoxic syndrome. And yes, I was his partner at home, and so we had to fight this together, and we still do.
You're amazing. I mean, you know, we're going to hear more from you, Annie, about your experiences, because I think what is missing from the podcast that I've done till now is getting the viewpoint of not the person who's actually suffering from erotoxic syndrome, but the indirect person. So this is a totally different side of seeing this sickness from another viewpoint. So your input, Annie, is going to be really important to the show and to other victims and their partners out there as well. So yeah, we will talk about this in detail.
Yeah, well, I'm Aap van der Kratz. As you said, I've been an airline pilot for 36 years. And first of all, I'd like to say I couldn't agree more than that the partner is a very important factor indeed when you get to this type of problems. He has been a really big support. I've flown for an airline for 36 years. I worked for a large Dutch airline first for 33 years. After that, I retired. But I was still feeling healthy and fit. I like my job a lot. And so when I got the chance, I continued to work for another 3 years for a large airline in South Korea until 2014. Then I was suddenly struck by erotoxic, although I had no clue at that time what that was. But I got on one afternoon, I got several acute symptoms like headache, dizziness, strong hearing loss. Later on, it turned out that I lost 30 decibels of my hearing on both sides in that afternoon. That's quite a lot. I had blurred vision, very fatigued, so I went home on sick leave. And then in the months after I got home, several more symptoms added to the initial ones. I got balance problems, vertigo, concentration, memory problems. And I got strong tremors in my left forearm. And on top of that, and that was probably one of the more serious things, actually, is that my whole thinking process that slowed down extremely. That was a very weird experience. I battled depressive feelings. I needed at least 12 to 14 hours of sleep a night. And plus often a good afternoon nap to get through the day. So I didn't have much of an energy then. I was a kind of a zombie and not the best company, I'm afraid. Luckily, I recovered a lot since, and together with my partner Annie, I'm now in Stifting Flyaware, where we try to help other victims of neurotoxic syndrome to get their life back on track and fight for the proper measures to ensure that clean cabin air and a healthy working environment for the present and the future generation of airline crews is coming into reality. That's basically where we stand.
Wow, amazing. That's really a very, I think, hard, difficult journey you've been through. And what I like, had the way you ended it when you said you're actually doing something for the future generations. That's what we all are striving for, that we have a better future, that the future generation do not have to go through what we are going through with aerotoxic syndrome. So it's amazing work what you and Annie are doing. So great job done. Thank you. Tell us your life before you actually had aerotoxic syndrome up.
Like many of my colleagues, I was absolutely fond of my job as a pilot. For many of us, it's like a hobby and a job in one combination, which is quite unique. It was my dream to become a pilot since I was a little boy, even though I had no clue what that would be like at that age. And later on, I got the chance to get my flight training at the Dutch Government Flight Academy, and I felt really privileged. And after finishing my training period, there wasn't too much of a demand for pilots. And so I spent a few years before getting the chance to join a big airline, which is the ultimate goal for most of us. In the year between, I did some flying in small aviation. And then I joined a big airline in our country, in the Netherlands. I flew the short and mid-range flights, mainly within Europe, for a relatively long time. And I was upgraded to a captain's position after 7 years. That was quite exciting, of course. I was just reached the age of 30. And although I've never been much of a sportsman, I generally did feel fit without any medical issues. My partner Annie and I got together at a somewhat later age in 2006, although we have known each other many, many years before that. And the last 5 years before my retirement, she would accompany me on most of my flights. A unique experience, of course, and a period we immensely enjoyed together. It's quite special to be on, say, Hong Kong Island one day and back in the Netherlands the next. It's much more than double the fun when you can share an experience like that. That's quite special. So in 2011, I retired at the age of 56, which is a requirement in that airline. These days, they have stretched that up to 58, I believe. I still felt healthy and fit at that time, and stopping my active career wasn't very appealing. So given the opportunity, I was quite happy to accept another job as a Captain 747 in South Korea. That meant a completely new episode, of course, operating on many new routes and destinations around the Pacific Ocean, but also an occasional trip to Europe. Living as an expat in a very different culture, many hours of commuting and repositioning as a passenger, besides all the hours as an active crew, that made this a very intense, but also a very interesting period, which I enjoyed a lot as well. Then the last 2 years, so 2010, 2011, I did notice that I needed to take some extra rest and sleep, needed to recover from the previous trip. I didn't worry about that. After all, I was getting older as well, and taking an occasional extra nap in your hotel room is usually not a problem. You're not disturbing anyone or anything, so you can do that. But in retrospect, I do realize that, in fact, fatigue was slowly building up already, even though I wasn't fully aware of it. And also, my short-term memory started hampering in that period.
So that's what I wanted to ask you, if you can give us some examples of your short-term memory, how it was affecting you at that point.
The best example of that came across is that on every aircraft, you have a number of so-called memory items. That's drills or short time critical procedures. You have to perform them by heart, like in case of an engine fire. There's certain actions that you need to do without looking for your checklist. So that's very basic in flying. It happened more and more often that I found myself on the way on the commute back to work, back to Seoul, as a passenger on board. You found yourself back reading through and rehearsing memory items of a 747. That's the aircraft I had been flying for 20 years. So that's quite remarkable. I never got into trouble really for not knowing the procedures during sim checks when I needed them, but the level of confidence was definitely decreasing. And that's a very unpleasant and alarming feeling. And probably it was a pre-warning of what was coming.
I've always wondered this, actually. You know, when I was flying, and I flew also for like 20 years, and the strange thing is when you do like arming the doors, you know, normal procedures, everyday procedures on board of an aircraft, it should be so easy to perform because you get habituated to it, right? So you get into the habit of arming and disarming. And so I would get really surprised at the end of the day on flight when I would actually kind of sometimes forget. And many crew go through that. And probably this is also one of the results of aerotoxic syndrome, that it affects your memory, the short-term memory that you have. And that is why you can't remember, or you start making mistakes and errors in normal duties that you should know by heart already, isn't it?
Yeah, you're very right there. And these actions, they are very deeply embedded in your system. And usually, the moment you really need them, they will come up. But when you get into this feeling of feeling unsure, suppose this happens tomorrow, do I know? That's a very uncomfortable feeling, especially after you've been flying a plane like that for years. That should not be any doubt at all.
Exactly. So, yeah. Okay. So, Up, how did you get aerotoxic syndrome?
As I know now, and the industry has known this for decades already, for a number of reasons, every jet engine will leak some oil into its bleeder. And that is inherent to the design of the bearings and the oil seals. This leakage will get worse during so-called power transients. That's the moments where, for instance, the engines are started and heating up, or when the power setting of the engine is changed. And it also increases over time as the engine ages. The air in that engine, the bleed air from that engine, is unfortunately used for pressurization and air conditioning of the cabin without any filtering at all. So as a consequence, this air of the leakage, this air will always contain a certain level of contamination by toxic oil vapors and pyrolyzed products. That was, however, never communicated with us pilots, and we certainly were not aware of the serious health risk of this leakage that it implies. Even today, the majority of pilots are still unaware of how serious this health threat really is, and many of them simply don't want to hear about it as well, as it poses a threat to their wonderful job. Then, I've never been in a spectacular fume event with dense smoke on board or anything like that. On the older planes like DC-9, however, it was considered quite normal to have a smell and or a bit of a smoke in the cabin after starting the APU or the engines at the first flight of the day. Top of descent, when the power levers were closed, or when starting the APU after the landing, this was also not uncommon. So in fact, those were all fume events, but we didn't consider this to be a health risk at that time at all. It was a nuisance at the most, and it would disappear after a few minutes or so. So nobody would be paying much attention to it, apart from reassuring the cabin crew and the passengers that it was quite normal, nothing to worry about. And as pilots, we were never specifically briefed about toxic fumes or health risk in relation to engine oils or hydraulic fluids or anything. And on top of that, you must realize that smoking was also normal at that time, smoking on board by passengers and even crew. And probably that concealed a good part of the oil, other smells in the cabin as well. So how I got aerotoxic syndrome, I mainly had a so-called long-term low-level exposure to the toxic substances like organophosphates, etc. You must realize that your body can break down a certain quantity of toxic substances per hour, per day, per 24 hours. That is genetically determined. And further, it's depending on a number of factors such as physical conditions, previous exposure, etc. So when you get just a bit more of these toxins in your body on a daily basis, then it can break down. It will get temporarily stored in fatty tissue. And this results in a slow buildup of toxins. You won't notice much of that. Maybe some relatively weak signs, as I described earlier. But you won't notice much of it until a certain critical level is reached. And then the dominoes start falling. The result is a sort of a system crash. It seems as if you suddenly fall very ill out of the blue, which is what happened to me on that Wednesday afternoon.
Wow, true. You mentioned that. So how has all of this impacted your life, Up?
Well, when I came home sick, I was really very tired. I had bad headaches, dizziness, and a bad short-term memory. My vision was blurred, and I had increasing problems with word finding. We had no clue what had happened at that time. Maybe it was a stroke or anything, but it appeared not to be the case. After about a month, we took a flight for a short vacation that had been planned long before that, together with friends. And during the arrival, as the airplane made a few perfectly normal turns, I suffered strong vertigo and got airsick, which is quite remarkable after all that time of professional flying. So, and after that, some more symptoms came up. I got repeated tremors in my left forearm, for some reason always my left forearm. And I needed lots of sleep. I had an extreme slow brain processing speed. I was unable to make any choices or find words. Camera of your eyes, as I described it once, will normally produce about 20 pictures per second, 20 frames per second. That results in a fluent movie in which you look into the world. In my case, that was reduced to maybe 3 to 4 pictures per second. That results in a kind of a slow motion experience. Really very weird experience, because everything is going too fast for you. I was unable to drive a car for 4 to 5 months. I suffered strong brain fog, vertigo, and I said that was kind of a zombie.
Wow, these are quite strong, your symptoms. This is how it impacted you. Can I come to Annie now? Annie, can I ask you how all of the symptoms that Aap showed, how has it impacted you as an outsider, as an observer?
Well, the impact of on our life was enormous. It was it brought uncertainty of what's happening in daily life, and you see the one who love you, who you love, suffering, and you both have really no clue what's all about. And our question was, where will this end? Because in the first time, more and more symptoms came up. And after looking back, sometime before he came home, we noticed some changes. Up as a person who is very much interested in the family life and very caring. So when he started working in South Korea, that meant being away from home for some weeks. And then he came back on leave. And in that time, we were, when possible, in FaceTime contact most every day. So we kept up each other on what happened in our daily lives. And more, however, he forgot what I've told him about. And when I said to him the next day, I told you yesterday, and then I got the reply, if I knew the answer I asked you, I wouldn't have asked it. So that happens more often. And at first you think, yes, he is far away from home. So, okay, he's not so much into what's happening at home, but it gave frustration at both sides. And afterwards, upset, yes. And then I thought, when you told it again, oh yes, she told it. So for him, also frustration. It was, after all, it was one of the first signs that things were getting wrong. Apart from the problems he already got for years, and that was regarding his body temperature, he could be in bed and so extremely cold or just flashing hot. And it was not normal, but he already had it for years. So also with that, you had no clue. Afterwards, we heard so many more people who have problems keeping their body temperature good. So when he got home, we had no clue what was the cause of his illness. And the symptoms get even worse. Tremors came, seizure of his arm for over an hour. He wasn't able to drive a car, like he said. After all, it was about 5 months or something. And even go for a short walk together from our house, it was impossible. I was too fast. The whole world was too fast. And then our moods changed from being glad he wasn't diagnosed with an incurable tumor, for example, to crying together in the uncertainty of where would this end. One of the worst moments for me was the time he became depressive. I know up since I was 12 years old, and he has never been depressive before. He's always optimistic, happy, cheerful. And it was about a year after he got home that he felt so terrible. I can say he felt so worthless. Mm-hmm. And that shocked me. And yeah, as his partner, completely unexperienced in depressive persons, I was in shock, and I just started to talk and I didn't stop. And in his tears, he said to me, "You are talking to me like a football coach." And then we laughed together. It was worrying.
Yes.
Yeah. And in this time, I was happy. I had stopped working earlier this year, so I had the time to become his personal driver, and I could bring him to every appointment. And like Ab said, we have been so lucky of being put on the right track by the tip of his colleague. Look into erotoxic. There are some more ex-colleagues who suffer from this. Both we searched on the internet and we were shocked what we found. We had no clue. And of course, up as a pilot, an employee of aviation company, he heard about things like this. And there has been a pilot who was in a court case with his employer. But And no one thought it would be so serious. And what we found out on the internet, it was shock by shock by shock. So in an early stage, Ab and I decided we wanted to help others who are struggling with these things and who haven't been so lucky to get at the right track so very soon. Because a lot of people got misdiagnosed and also false medications. And yes, from that thought of helping people, I started myself a Facebook group, Toxic Flyer. This group failed because of my inexperience. It turned out that people who are suffering don't prefer to speak out in the open. And a lot of people are scared to talk about it. They are scared, as long as they still work for that airline, they are scared that their colleagues will laugh about them, because they don't think it is true, it is serious what's happening. And at that time, I had no idea of existing international aerotoxic groups. And when Ab got home, shortly after that, he got a tip to go to Dr. John Midavan for treatment. John Midavan is an otomolecular therapist, and I drove him there. John Midavan has been treating people with aerotoxic symptoms for over about 8 years now. And 2 years ago, FlyAware has been founded. And the three of us, John Midavan, Ab and I, became board members. And also with the thought to help people and to inform people, as well cabin crew, as well cockpit crew, as well passengers. Next to that, John Midavan is keeping up medical contacts, and he runs his own clinic, Life Medic, in the Netherlands. Ab maintains our website of FlyAware, and I'm the admin of our social media group, Facebook group, Stichting FlyAware, and I try to keep up with the international and national contacts. Our personal plans has changed, of course, because of this, where we had plans when after up retirement to fly around the world. We have seen a lot of the world during his professional career, but it was always short. And so we had plans to go for longer trips. And yes, of course, we had to change our plans. Ab is not boarding any aircraft anymore, not even as a passenger. He doesn't dare. And that's, yeah, you can't imagine that after 36 years of professional flying. Flying is his life. But like we said, life is still more than worth living. We take our car out now for holidays. And yeah, this is where we are now.
Wow, amazing, amazing. Oh my God, you've been such a strong person, Annie, and Ab as well. It's amazing, your story, really inspirational. I must think, Annie, for you, this whole thing must have been quite shocking, you know, to see this transformation of your partner from this happy person to this sad, depressive person. During all this time when you saw this transformation, I know at that time you didn't know it was because of the aerotoxic syndrome, but did you ever feel that you personally were the cause of his depression? And if you did, how did you manage to work out of it, to work through it? Did you stay strong? What did you have to do yourself to fight through all of this as well?
I never thought I was the cause of the depression. Our relationship is very, very good. And no, I just felt so sorry for him. And it hurt me with it. It hurt deep in my heart. And I know, yeah, for him, I felt so sorry, but also for all the people who are suffering, and especially the ones who have no clue what's happening, because we dived into it very deep. We searched on the net. We learned from others. Yeah, we studied as much as we can about this. So I understood what was happening and only felt sorry. I couldn't help him, just support him. That was what I could do.
And I like that you say we. So I think it made you stronger as a couple as well, right? The fact that you all tried to look for more information and try to work it out together, it strengthened your relationship as a couple as well, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And our relationship is very strong. But what we said, sometimes it takes a lot of time. Also the work for the nonprofit foundations, Stichting FlyAware, it takes a lot of time, and it's only that you do it as a couple. Otherwise, you get problems in your relationship, I think.
Yes, true. Because then he's spending too much time on it. And again, he's away from you. But this way, you all have bonded, and you know, you've become kind of one person now.
Yeah.
Okay, let's get back to Up then. Up, where are you now with your recovery process? Are you completely healed or do you still show some symptoms and are you working through it?
To start off with the negative part, no, I'm not completely healed. And I really doubt whether I ever will be. But I've been very lucky. And as we said, our strong relationship, support and the solidarity of Annie and the help of John Midaveen, my therapist. With that, I have recovered for a good part. John's guidance is very professional. He prescribed food supplements and also referred me for some supporting therapies at a certain point. And they got me back to a much better level. The last brain fog, which I wasn't really aware of it anymore, but the last brain fog finally disappeared last January when I started using CBD oil. That's the version that is legal in our country these days. It doesn't contain any THC, if that means anything to you. But THC is the substance that would make you high. And this version of CBD oil, that is not present. But the CBD had a huge impact. I literally lost that last brain fog after 3 or 4 days, I believe. Annie.
4 days.
And I woke up the fourth morning after starting to use that, just 2 drops a day. And for the first time in 4.5 years, I felt, whoa, my head is clear and I'm there. So that was quite exciting. I do take some more sleep still than I used to. Still should have about 10 hours a day, which is quite a lot. But with that, I can function pretty normal, most of the time at least. So, but things like handling stress or very busy group conversations, that is still difficult, not only for my hearing, but also because, well, it feels like my brain cannot keep up. So I get very tired. It drains my energy. Another example, my fine motor skills, like handwriting. I never had a very good handwriting, but these days that has gone a lot backwards. It is a lot worse than it used to be. So I don't think that will get any better than it is now.
So can I ask you, when you say brain fog, what are the symptoms of brain fog? What actually happens? What do you feel?
That's very difficult to give a good description, but it is like it comes close to when you drink too much. You're sort of drunk. Your reaction will be slow. It seems like you're not fully conscious, sort of half sleep. And if I get an example, as I said, I wasn't really aware of the remaining brain fog anymore last winter. We were in Austria on skiing and I was good enough to do that. It went okay, but just okay, not more than that. And after these 4 days of taking these CBD oil, I noticed the difference that I was still lagging behind, put it that way. If you're skiing on the mountain, and especially when the snow conditions are not optimum, but there are many people and they ski the snow into ridges that you have to correct every time, I was lagging behind. So keeping my balance was taking so much energy that after one slope, I was tired. So that was it. Then all of a sudden, I was able to be ahead and anticipate on where can I turn easiest. And my balance correction was so much better that it takes only a fraction of the energy. That made a really big, big difference.
And this was because of the CBD oil then?
Exactly, yeah.
And what does CBD stand for, may I ask, for the listeners in case they don't know what this is? Does it mean something, CBD?
It's from cannabis, actually. It's cannabidiol. Cannabinoids are, in fact, substances that are present in your body naturally. They're sort of a key, as far as I understood, to certain gates to your body cells. They fit on a receptor that every body cell has, and they allow things like energy flow to increase a lot. So in that sense, it is understandable that it makes you a lot more direct in reactions. One thing I'd like to tell, a small story. After about a year, I was improving. I felt at that time I was improving a lot, but I was worried or curious, actually, more what it would be like to learn something new, if I would be able to do that, because I had been so far away, to put it that way, that I was curious to see how that would go. And as a youngster, I was already quite fond of motorbikes. I liked that, but I never got to get my license to ride one. I did ride motorbike, a bit of it, illegally at that age, but I never got to get my license. And so in 2015, when I was improving, I was like, geez, if I want to do that, I shouldn't wait for another 10 years. Let's see how that goes. So I did. And I must say, I didn't pass in one go. I did need 3 attempts, but I did get my license, and I'm enjoying that so much. That is fantastic.
Amazing, yeah. Right? So you actually proved a point to yourself.
Absolutely. Yeah? And that motorbike is such a freedom to enjoy. And I have been doing some larger tours with ex-colleagues and good friends, also across the border towards the Alps and all that. That is really wonderful. That's amazing. So I'm very happy that I can do that.
Amazing. So what are your, after all you've been through, what are your thoughts and feelings about aerotoxic syndrome?
First of all, I think aerotoxic syndrome is what I would call a silent killer. It has been for many years. Its victims develop serious ill health, either acute or after a fume event, or gradually as a result of long-term low-level exposure to highly toxic substances. That very exposure has been categorically denied for many, many years by both the industry and the authority. And even today, this huge problem is still being swept under the carpet, as factors like money and profit are much more important in our society than health or even human lives. And because aerotoxic syndrome is widely ignored and denied, crew members or passengers who develop these health problems can barely come out with them. They are often not understood or even taken serious, which adds considerably to such related problems as depression that we mentioned earlier. It is really time for the industry, for the medical world, and for the authorities to recognize aerotoxic syndrome as an occupational disease and a real threat to the health of both crew and passengers.
True that, true. Can you also share with us your viewpoint on ways to improve our current situation?
Well, a few things must happen, and that's what we are striving for in our Stifting FlyAware, the recognition of aerotoxic syndrome as an occupational disease so that victims can get better treatment, such as proper detoxing, instead of adding heavy medication to a body that is already overloaded with toxins. Annie mentioned shortly already that there have been many, many misdiagnoses for aerotoxic patients. They are diagnosed with such things as burnout, Parkinson, MS, and the resulting medication that you get is doing the opposite of what you want. It's adding extra poison to your body, and that is already overloaded. And they should make sure that every crew member is aware of the seriousness of cabin air contamination and fume events, which is not the case yet. Give them additional training so they have the proper tools as well for action to limit the impact of an occasional fume event that will still happen, of course. And then what is urgent, the industry must build in the fuel flow bleed air filters that are now coming available to get cleaner cabin air, and also detectors to warn the crew of the presence of any harmful substances so they can take proper action and limit the impact of any pollution there. And then in the end, of course, a total ban on the use of bleed air for pressurization and air conditioning of future aircraft types. That is a really, really bad system that should disappear on new aircraft types. And the 787 from Boeing and A350 from Airbus have shown in the meantime that this is technically feasible. Boeing has even stated that the reason for building bleedless system into the 787 Dreamliner is not the clean air. They state that it improves the aircraft's fuel efficiency, which is a very important factor for any new aircraft if you want to sell it. So that is where the industry needs to go.
Yeah. Now, I know you and Annie and John have founded the FlyAware, and I've been on your site, and it's really very informative. Could you tell us, you've already mentioned a lot about it, but just a few things about your journey on your inspiration behind FlyAware?
Stifting FlyAware is providing the means to collect and to publish a lot of information and tips, as you just mentioned. You've seen our website. And we can share that info with the public and promote further awareness among crew and frequent flyers. We want aerotoxic syndrome to come out of the dark. This is a really gross scandal. It has to be stopped. Proper measures have to be taken to make sure that the present and the future generations of cockpit and cabin crew can finish their wonderful career in aviation in good health. It's not for nothing that they call this aerotoxic syndrome, it's often called the asbestos scandal of the sky.
Yeah.
And I'm actually convinced that once it does come out, it comes to the surface, the scandal is at least as big as the asbestos scandal was years ago. That's the main thing. Yeah.
Up, how do you see the future?
The future is, the wheel is obviously moving, and I'm sure it will become more and more difficult for the industry to stop it. There is an increase in media attention for fume events. It comes to the news more often. Also, as a result, again, of media attention and the work we try to do, it's more and more crew do become aware of the problem of contamination of the cabin air. So there is definitely some movement there. And this summer, after some delay, EasyJet and Spirit Airlines in the US are building in full-flow bleed air filters in their entire fleet, while the Lufthansa Group will do extensive testing, as we heard, with such filters on a number of their aircraft. And it seems to me only logic for a highly commercial company like EasyJet, for instance, once they have installed these systems, they will use that for marketing. Come and fly with us. We offer you clean air. That might work very well. Apart from that, I think there are only two good reasons for the airline industry to motivate them to invest in this clean air technology in the near future. And the first one is when the authorities would recognize the public health threat and force them to do so, take preventive measures. They will have to be allowed to operate. The second reason, when passengers start to realize that the air in a company like EasyJet is indeed better and they are given the choice, they could develop a preference. They could start preferring to fly with a company that has this clean air over another company that doesn't. And that would make them feel this in their profits. So that would be a very motivating reason to make sure you're up ahead as well and join in that development. Unfortunately, money is the one and only drive for the industry. It has been proven to be much more important than safety and more important than health or even human lives. I think money will ultimately also be the only drive for the industry to invest in clean air and to safeguard their further profits.
Yeah, sad. That's really sad. What would your advice be to people in general?
Yeah, on our website, www.flyaware.nl, we collected some tips for passengers and crew to limit the impact on your body of things like fatigue, time zone traveling, jet lag, and cabin air contamination. Just to name a few here, make sure to take sufficient rest and sleep, as well as a well-rested body can better resist the extra burden of traveling and also is better able to battle any factors like air contamination. It will be better able to detox and etc. Limit the use of alcohol on board because that impacts you more than on the ground. Well, that's relatively obvious, I think. Another thing is preferably do not drink any coffee, tea or tap water on board, because the tap water on board that is also being used for coffee and tea is also contaminated by bleed air and by disinfecting substances. You can read more about this on our website in several short articles. Then the fourth one is by far the most important tip that we recommend is always carry a good quality face mask with you. Don't leave it in your hand luggage in the overhead bin, because if a fume event would occur, you would probably not get the chance to get it out. You should keep it in the seat pocket in front of you within immediate reach, and you should indeed wear it during periods of power transient as engines starting takeoff and landing, but also in periods of turbulence. So in general, I translate my tip for passengers as follows. When the seatbelt sign goes on, seatbelt on means mask on. Easy to remember, and that covers all these situations. A good quality mask, by the way, is made by British Cambridge Mask Company, and their masks are also available via our website.
Amazing, all the tips you're giving, and actually now you made me think about the tap water on board of the aircraft, and I completely forgot about that, but it's true that it's even contaminated by the bleed air, so you then ingest all these toxins into your body even quicker than breathing it in. That's an important point here.
Yes, yeah. And the reason why the water system is contaminated, by the way, in short, is that the water is stored in storage tanks below the passenger floor level. And during flight, aircraft do not use something like an electric pump to pump it up. Again, that is except for the 787 Dreamliner. But they use the same bleed air to pressurize the water tank. And that is how the water is pushed up to the taps and to the coffee makers. And unfortunately, that water does get contaminated as well.
Crazy, yeah? You forget all these small things. But now that you're mentioning it, that's another thing that should be seriously looked into as well. Okay, another question I have is, do you have any more information you'd like to share with the listeners?
Yeah, there's a few more things that we just passed over. I did intend to mention. Stichting FlyAware is also an associate member of the Global Cabin Air Quality Executive, GCAQE, in London. That's an international umbrella organization that does a lot of research and promotes clean cabin air. Members are mainly cockpit and cabin trade unions from around the globe, including Australia, USA, and most Western European countries. Unfortunately, the Dutch unions have so far not joined this company, despite repeated attempts, amongst others from our side, to convince them to do so. It's a really frustrating situation as far as we are concerned. One would expect them to stand firm for their members and their health. So far, they have been disappointingly passive in this field, where, for instance, the German union Vereinigung Cockpit in the UK Unite, the union, and also the European Cockpit Association have repeatedly taken firm stands for clean cabin air. It's a remarkable situation which hopefully will change in the future. This year, in September, GCAQE will be organizing a big international conference again in London, as they did in 2017. And it's a great opportunity to learn the latest developments in this field. So, of course, Stichting FlyAware will also attend to that important meeting. Then, on the 10th of May, Stichting FlyAware will be organizing an information evening in Nijkerk about contaminated cabin air and the aerotoxic syndrome. I will explain a bit there on how cabin air gets contaminated, and our chairman, automolecular Dr. Jan-Mida Vern, has some info to share about the health aspects involved. And our main subject will be our guest speaker from Belgium, Daniel Dumoulin, who you have been interviewing before. He will do a presentation about his important research into brain damage as a result of aerotoxic syndrome. The evening will, by the way, be in the Dutch language. It will be very informative and interesting for anybody interested in these subjects. These subjects are still way too much unknown to people. I have a few links there that you will undoubtedly add to the blog where people can find more information. Or they can simply go to our website, www.flyaware.nl, and click on the big green button at the top for more information and also to get tickets. Then for those of the listeners who don't speak Dutch, there's another information evening that will be organized later this year by the Belgian Union ACV in Rotselaar, Belgium. They also did that before, and that will be in English. If you watch our website and the other aerotoxic Facebook groups, you will find more information as it comes available.
Wow, that's great. Yeah, that's true. I will put all the descriptions that you just mentioned. I'll put it onto the description of this episode as well as on my blog, so the listeners can contact you whichever way they want or get more information on this event that you're having on the 10th of May. It's amazing. And I will also be part of it because I'd like to hear what Daniel has to say. He was on last week. I'd also like to hear John Middervain speak as well. So it'll be quite informative. So thank you very much for actually organizing that.
Well, we're more than happy to do that. And we really hope that it will be a well-visited meeting that evening. The more people know about this, the better.
Of course, true that. So my last question is, how can the listeners contact you?
www.flyaware.nl. Mm-hmm. If they want to contact us, they can use info@flyaware.nl or me in person if they prefer that. It's up@flyaware.nl.
Okay, that's great. We've come to the end of the show. Unfortunately, you've given me and the listeners so much information. Annie and Up, I'd like to thank you very much for all the incredible work you both are doing to help and support the aerotoxic victims. And please keep up the good work, both of you.
Thank you very much. We certainly intend to do that and hope we get this subject out of the world as soon as we can.
Thank you very much, Griselda. We admire you for all the work you do, and we thank you again for inviting us for the show.
Oh, that's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Annie. Thank you so much, Ab. So I'd like to wish you both a lovely evening and stay strong. And you guys are like, how should I say, the role model to couples and how to stay strong through all of it.
thank you so much.
Okay, thank you. So have a lovely evening then and see you next time, yeah? Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining the Three Pillars. See you next week.